Fighting Relations Radio, an experimental podcast where we explore perspectives, stories, tools, innovations, experiments with transformative adult education and radical social change across Turtle Island. And we're joined here. My name is Rehana Tejpar, and we're joined with John McFedrin Waitzer, who is someone that we connected through the resource movement that John works with. And I'm so happy to have you. Welcome, John.
Thanks so much, Rehana. Mm. It's so lovely to be having this conversation.
Yeah, we could talk for hours and hours.
And we do sometimes.
And we do. So this is an extension of that, just to open it up to share with others. You just inspire me so much with all that you bring and the work that you do.
Same.
And so can you tell us a bit about yourself and who you are and your passions?
Sure. My name is John. In case anyone listening ever wants to refer to me in the third person, I use they and them pronouns. And I grew up here on Turtle Island as a white settler. I grew up mostly in Toronto, Tekaronto, and now I call Jojage or Montreal my home. And I am, a white, Jewish, queer and genderqueer person. And I've ended up working in adult education for the last several years. And I think, like a lot of people working in adult education, I like didn't conceive of the work that way until it was like put to me by someone else who was like, oh yeah, this is the field that you're a part of. For me, how I came to this work, I guess, was through my search for personal healing in a lot of ways. My background professionally for the last many years has been working in the nonprofit sector, first in like a big international social entrepreneurship NGO called Ashoka, and then in a very grassroots community organization in Montreal called Head in Hands, which is a youth support and social change enabling organization. And I have sort of been on this quest to figure out the good way for me to contribute my gifts to the work of social justice and social change. Understanding that I've been socialized into privilege in a number of ways that make it complicated for me to be a part of movements for social justice. So I grew up in a wealthy household. I'm a white person. I'm not a man, but I was socialized into masculinity. And so connecting with the resource movement, which is an organization that mobilizes young people with class privilege to participate in movements for the radical redistribution of land, wealth, and power, is something that I found while I was trying to answer those questions for myself. How do I, as a young person with class privilege and other privileges, participate in those movements in a good way?
Thank you. And for anyone who's interested in the resource movement, I think it's a really amazing resource and, an amazing body of knowledge and people power that that have a lot to share. And, so I invite us all to go and look at them.
www.resourcemovement.org.
Awesome. Thank you. We've been chatting about this amazing new book that has just come out by Nora Samaran, Turn This World Inside Out, The Emergence of Nurturance Culture. And it's going to weave its way through our conversation. And one of the threads I'd like to just begin to tug on is a little bit on this notion of the fragility of privilege.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so the fragility of privilege. I think maybe the first thing to say is to acknowledge that the fragility of privilege draws directly on the thinking of Robin DiAngelo, who coined the term white fragility, and that what we're talking about here is a recognition that Every system of like supremacy and dominance creates fragility in the people who benefit materially from that system. And that the reason that happens is that, you know, while we're benefiting materially from any system of supremacy, we're being harmed spiritually. And that it's that like juxtaposition that makes us fragile. And so for me in the work that I do specifically with people with class privilege, so who are benefiting materially from capitalism, the first step in doing the work together that supports each other in being able to work towards social justice in a good way is to recognize the myths of meritocracy, the myth of capitalist supremacy that holds up our society. You know, mm-hmm. like the fact that any of us believes that a person can earn $100 million, $1 billion, $50 billion, is, I think, if you take a second to think about it, ridiculous. That, you know, like sort of someone can possibly work that much harder than a person who is holding three jobs and living in poverty to earn that much more money.
Mm-hmm.
And that the sort of cognitive dissonance that those of us who are benefiting materially from capitalism experience when that like deep knowledge of the sort of the falseness of the myth of supremacy that holds it up runs up against the sort of the comfort that we gain from accepting those myths. That cognitive dissonance is super hard to hold, and that it leads us to numb certain parts of ourselves in order to not experience that dissonance, and that's you know what it looks like usually like from a pretty young age to be socialized into a system of supremacy. And that's like a wound that we carry, and that wound makes us really fragile because we're on a deep level, we're aware of that wound wherever we go. And when we bump up against things that sort of, you know, threaten to touch that part of ourselves that we've numbed, it's like, it feels really scary. And so we, you know, when we were talking earlier, you asked me like, what does fragility mean for me? And yeah, we came up together with sort of like these two pieces where when we're fragile, we perceive difference as a challenge because difference suggests that the myth of like things being the way they are because they need to be the way they are isn't true. And then also when we're fragile, we perceive challenge as an attack because we are so invested in the myth of things being the way they are because that's the right way for things to be, that any suggestion that it might be otherwise, it threatens to bring us into contact with that part of ourselves that we've numbed, and that's so painful. And so it feels like an attack, even though it's not actually.
Hmm.
And that's a core part of the work that we do amongst each other is to work on deconditioning that fragility, building up our resilience so that we can be with difference, so we can be with challenge, and not become reactive, you know, not collapse and get into like flight mode, not be triggered and become sort of like reactive and get into fight mode, and actually be with difference. And you know, from what I understand of the work that, for example, men's groups do together when they're working on sort of building nurturance culture, and from what I've experienced of the work that white anti-racist groups do together, it's essentially the same work. It's this work of excavating these wounds that we've accepted as the price we pay to be a part of a system of supremacy, and then looking at those wounds together and like, you know, caring for them in a way that allows us to reconnect authentically and accountably with people who are on the other side of that system of supremacy. And since you brought up Nora's book, there's this quote that's in the book that I find super powerful. And it's a quote from Adrienne Marie Brown, who's of course another brilliant brilliant person who we love.
Brilliant.
and who has two books out now, Emergent Strategy and Pleasure Activism, yeah. both of which everyone listening to this podcast should read.
Absolutely.
but Adrian's quote, you know, touching on what we were just talking about, is where we are born into privilege, we are charged with dismantling any myth of supremacy. And where we are born into struggle, we are charged with claiming our dignity, our joy, and our liberation. And yeah, to me, this has always felt really powerful because of how it points to our paths to personal healing being the same, or at least being very connected to the paths that we need to walk to sort of play our part in healing the world.
Yes.
I don't know what that brings up for you.
So much.
Yeah, I hope
yes.
so.
Yes. Well, what's coming up for me is that quote is so profound, and immediately the first time I heard it was like, oh, I'm both those things. And then you said, yes, we all are. We all are trying to, mm-hmm. You know, dispel the myth of our supremacy mm-hmm. in some aspect of ourselves mm-hmm. that has been deemed mm-hmm. supreme. Mm-hmm. And we're also trying to reclaim our own dignity and deservingness of joy. Mm-hmm.
For parts that. Of ourselves that have been deemed unworthy.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. And then holding those two pieces at the same time. Urpi Pine, in our last episode of Writing Relations Radio, spoke about the seventh direction. Mm-hmm. And it reminds me of being in the seventh direction. So we have the four directions of north, east, south, west. Mm-hmm. We have the earth and sky. Mm-hmm. And the seventh direction is inside us.
Yeah.
So we are the seventh direction. And so being able to hold both that, the multiplicity of truths of needing to honor ourselves as sacred and divine, and at the same time humble ourselves to that we are not more sacred and divine than anyone else, mm-hmm. and balancing those scales mm-hmm. is it comes with that real in internal centeredness, mm-hmm. that space of seeing in all directions.
Mm-hmm. There's something that comes up for me when you sort of name this seventh direction of, like, I guess I hear it as in, right? Like the sort of like north, east, south, west, up, down, and in.
Yeah.
And I'm going to go back actually to Nora's book, where she does a lot of weaving of sort of the personal and the interpersonal and the systemic, which we've talked about. And she draws on this concept from psychology of attachment theory, where you know, that there's briefly that, like, that there's this notion that we develop really strong sort of like patterns or instincts around how we navigate intimacy when we're very, very young, based on the experiences we have with our parents or caregivers, and that there's, you know, some of us who receive closeness and autonomy in what feels to us like a healthy balance. And so we end up having a secure attachment style where we can pretty easily navigate distance and closeness when we with someone that we feel intimate with. And then that there's a lot of us who didn't receive what felt like a healthy balance of those things, and that we have an insecure attachment instinct, and that either manifests as sort of anxious, where we protest and we, like, you know, try to control when we feel distance that we're not comfortable with, because we have this, like, fear that we're going to be abandoned. And then others, we have an avoidant attachment style, mm-hmm. which means that we sort of, like, cut people off when we're afraid that they might abandon us, so that, you know, we can, like, abandon them first.
Yeah.
And that all of this comes from a sort of a lack of connection to ourselves. Mm-hmm. And that in particular, going back to the fragility of privilege, that, yeah, being conditioned into white supremacy, patriarchy, capitalism, whatever, again, it cuts us off from a part of ourselves. And that, like, so much of what manifests as, like, harm in society is, you know, like us grappling in an insecure way with like the wound of being detached from ourselves. Mm-hmm. And that the answer to that is healing, versus like sacrifice or versus, you know, like further erasing the self. Mm-hmm. But that the answer is actually turning inwards and like moving towards the self. Mm-hmm. For me anyway, is like such a liberating concept.
Mm-hmm. 100%. And it sounds like this work of healing, acknowledging this separation, it's interesting because you're speaking of it in the context of a privileged group, and I'm reminded of Sherry Mitchell, who wrote Sacred Instructions, Indigenous Wisdom for Living Spirit-Based Change, Penobscot attorney and speaker, writer from Penobscot Territory in Maine. And she talks about how colonization has impacted every single one of us. Mm-hmm. You know, it's impacted the colonizer, the colonized, and all of it is connected to separation. That's what colonization has done, is separated us from ourselves, from each other, from the land. And that this work that we're doing now is, you know, like some call it the work, is it Joanna Macy, the work that reconnects?
Yeah, totally.
Yes. Or some say that it's the great turning or the decolonization or writing relations or, but it is that reconnecting, that bridging those divides. And it really does start with the self, that the more space I can hold for myself, the more love I can have for myself, the more space I can hold for you, the more love I can have for you. Mm-hmm. Because I'm not separate from you, actually. Mm-hmm. It's an illusion that we're separate. Sherry talks about this a lot as well, is the greatest myth that we've ever been fed is that we're separate from
totally
everything.
Yeah.
That we're individuals. Mm-hmm. And so we're in this time of grappling with it, that rebonding. And it being okay to need to be fragile, to need things, to say I love you, to say I'm in pain, to express I feel kind of jealous right now. I feel insecure about the way that, you know, and how to also just unlearn this notion of competition. When you talked about this, the difference gets perceived as a challenge. Mm-hmm. And the challenge can get perceived as an attack. And in the notion of this fragility of privilege, I think about it, and maybe it's because the privileged have curated this society, this dominant society at least, in its likeness, that even in conversation amongst people of who are not supposed to, like, quote unquote privilege, I feel like that if a person is saying something that's not in alignment or agreement, that it's often perceived as an attack. It's often perceived as whoa, now we're having a debate. Mm-hmm. Now we're having and it's going to be about who can win this argument. Mm-hmm. Who's got the best idea? And I feel school system also, you know, turns out this type of behavior. Mm-hmm. And I wonder how we can, you know, shift those mindsets and develop the skill sets to communicate in a different way that is really about deep listening, holding each other up, still expressing our truth, even if it is different from what another says, without it spiraling into conflict because of our differences.
Mm-hmm. I'm really interested in that and like curious about it in terms of, you know, there being certain types of fragility that are specific to being socialized into one or another kind of privilege. And then there are other kinds of fragility that are just about being in this culture. And that makes all of us less able to connect with each other and also with ourselves because of how, you know, inside of ourselves, nothing is linear. Out in the world, nothing is actually linear. And yeah, that this sort of like this myth of the possibility of control is something that you know, I think maybe it's those of us who are socialized into like a privileged position in like hierarchized society are like conditioned to have a harder time letting go of that myth. But that, yeah, of course, you know, we're that myth is fed to us regardless of our position in society.
Yeah, the image that's coming to me is the triangle. Mm. And I'm thinking like a pyramid, and I'm thinking about the training I recently did with Dialogue for Peaceful Change. Mm-hmm. And how we learn about this what is underneath conflict is this hierarchical structure that says that, you know, at the top you're in power, you're in control, you're the winner, and if you're at the bottom, you're the loser. And and so you're, you know, fill in the blank with whatever derogative term you would like, poor, useless, whatever. And everyone in this society is trying to climb this ladder to get to the top. Mm-hmm. And it's cutthroat. It's like a dog-eat-dog world, you know? And we're taught that if you don't, you know, fight, if you don't climb, you will end up at the bottom, and people will step all over you, and you'll be homeless and poor and miserable. And so maybe that's in our, it's so deeply interwoven in our sense of survival now, that I'm not going to let you win this argument because I'm trying to win at life. I'm trying to survive.
And life is zero sum.
Exactly.
And like what you get needs to take away from me.
Exactly. Exactly.
Yeah, totally. That actually, it brings up another quote that I first thought of and started like looking for actually, when you brought up the teaching from,
Sherry Mitchell.
From Sherry. Exactly. Mm-hmm. But, yeah, this quote is from James Baldwin. And it always makes me think about how, yeah, the purpose of all of these systems of domination is to sort of create a world where we don't have to face what it really means to like connect with ourselves and each other, because of this feeling that we don't have the tools to do that, and like where does that come from, you know? And I think that again, one way of understanding that is that we all come from some kind of trauma, and that sort of the system that have been created by the groups that are currently dominating society and the world were created as a response to trauma, as a response to, you know, not feeling enough, not feeling safe, and that in order to get to a place where, you know, we as members of those groups and then those groups as a whole stop harming other people, we need to get to a point where it's like where we can actually believe that, you know, we'll be safe if we don't create others to sort of like offload our insecurities and our rage and our fears and our grief on. And so, yeah, James Baldwin has this quote where he says, I do not know many Negroes who are eager to be accepted by white people, still less to be loved by them. They, the blacks, simply don't wish to be beaten over the head by the whites every instant of our brief passage on this planet. White people will have quite enough to do in learning how to accept and love themselves and each other. And when they have achieved this, which will not be tomorrow and may very well be never, the Negro problem will no longer exist because it will no longer be needed.
And
so,
profound.
Yeah, you know, like really putting his finger on sort of, and this is something he did throughout his life, right? Was to push back when curious white people would ask him to talk about the Negro problem, and where he'd be like, no, like the problem of racism in America is a problem with like the collective soul of white people.
Yes.
And I don't want to talk to you about like a problem that black people have. I want to talk to you about the problem that white people have.
That have created these these divisions of race and constructed this difference. Yeah, in the first place. Mm-hmm. Wow, that's beautiful. Wow. So my mind is going in two separate directions. I mean, the first thing that came up as I was listening to you was the prophecy of the seven fire prophecy of the Anishinaabe and the lighting of the eighth fire, which is alive right now. Mm-hmm. You know, that was spoken.
We're in the eighth fire.
We're
yeah.
in the seventh fire.
The seventh fire.
And
sorry.
We're hoping we can light the eighth fire. And so, you know, for those of you who've not read that, Sherry Mitchell does a wonderful job at recounting this prophecy at the end of her book as well. That there have been several fires which mark different times in history. Documenting sort of that they prophesized the Anishinaabe people, including the coming of the Europeans and colonization. And then when they talked about this time, I'm not going to go into the whole prophecy, but speaking of this time, they said there would be extreme, you know, they didn't say extreme weather, but they said that the earth would shake, that she would have a fever, that the water would light on fire, that there would be all these storms and that yes, we see this happening now, and that there would be those who would listen to the ways of the old ones, of the elders, that would go back to listening to those elders, and some of those elders will have gone quiet because no one would have listened to them for so long, mm-hmm. and they will have forgotten that they have something to share. Some will remember and will share, and those people who come from all the nations mm-hmm. would remember the ways of the circle, listening to those old teachings, mm-hmm. and would come together to protect the earth. And at the same time, the white people, being the most powerful people, would have the final straw, essentially. If they chose mm-hmm. to remember the ways of the circle, they could save themselves and all of humanity and the planet. Mm-hmm. And if they chose not, then they would die, and so would all of humanity.
They would die and kill everyone else.
And kill everyone else.
Yeah.
And it speaks exactly to what James is saying. Mm-hmm. Like when the white people can heal themselves and remember, you know, who they
when the right white people and the rich people and the men, can all do that or not.
So can you tell us? Can you share a little bit? You know, I'm sure there's a lot of people that are resonating with this right now, but then they're asking themselves, like, well, what does that look like? How do I heal?
Yeah, totally.
What do these spaces contain? What are the elements that? What are the conditions that support healing of mm-hmm. this kind? And
totally.
As an adult educator, maybe share some of the tools or things that you might bring in.
Sure. Yeah, and I guess I want to bring Adrian's quote back here to sort of scope the kind of healing work that I focus on in my adult education practice, again, Adrian said, where we are born into privilege, we are charged with dismantling any myth of supremacy. Where we are born into struggle, we are charged with claiming our dignity, joy, and liberation. And yeah, like you and like everyone else, I identify with both of those paths. And, you know, there are parts of that personal and collective healing work that I do in community with folks who I'm in struggle with, you know, with like sort of my queer and trans and genderqueer family. And that's a part of my personal practice and my organizing practice. And it's not the work that I'm most excited to talk about with you today. But I guess I just want to say, like, you know, that is all, of course, still so important. And we all need to find ways to reclaim our joy and dignity and liberation with our communities that we struggle with. And then there's the other part, which is sort of working with the people, our community of people with whom we share privilege, to dismantle those particular myths of supremacy that feed our privilege. And so I can share a little bit more about what that looks like within Resource Movement, where we are we're a national movement of millennials and Gen Z folks. So young people defined very loosely in terms of like 18 to 40 years old, which is great for me because I'm 35. So like not a youth by most measures of the word. And the work that we do is really particularly focused on dismantling the myth of capitalist meritocracy, or capitalist supremacy, which shows up as the myth of meritocracy, mm. that sort of we deserve our economic positions within society based on how hard we work. What we find when we try to face that together is that there's like so many, you know, subtle ways that we end up like propping that myth up in our lives, and where that myth ends up separating us from other people. And the other thing I should say is that we are incredibly fortunate to draw on, you know, we've only been around for 2 years, but we're able to draw on 20 years of work by an organization called Resource Generation, which is based in the US, and that was the direct inspiration for our work. So yeah, Resource Generation has had 20 years of being like in community and like in movements and thinking this through, and they've been so generous with us in terms of sharing their materials, sharing their learnings. Incredible. And so, you know, what they've developed and then what we've adapted is like a series of tools and practices for coming together in circle among people who share this particular experience of privilege, and then who are often really different in terms of where we fit into privilege and struggle in the rest of our lives. So, you know, a lot of us are like class privileged or wealthy, and also queer or also female or also trans or also racialized. And then some of us are, you know, all of like wealthy and white and male. And it's a really like rich exchange there. But we focus on the shared path to healing that we have because of the shared privilege of like class privilege. And we do storytelling. So one way that we unlearn, I want to bring back Adrian's words exactly. Yeah, one way that we dismantle the myth of class supremacy amongst ourselves is this tool that we call money stories, where we recognize that the stories that we mostly tell each other about money in society are shaped in a few ways to continuously prop up this myth. One of those ways is that there's this massive taboo against naming numbers. Naming numbers around income, naming numbers around wealth, savings, mm-hmm. inheritance, that there's this like massive sort of like cult of secrecy around money that we're usually not even aware of consciously.
It's so true.
Yeah. And of course that reinforces the myth of meritocracy, right? Because we don't have access to the information that would allow us to actually understand what someone else's situation is.
Right.
And so when we tell our money stories, we name numbers. And then the other part of the money stories in society as a whole that serve to prop up the myth of meritocracy is this sort of like persistent pattern of not naming unearned advantages in our like family stories of wealth and not naming participation in structural violence. Mm-hmm. So, you know, like the classic money story of like, oh yeah, like our family is rich, I guess. And, you know, like there was a, like a great uncle somewhere who, you know, started with nothing and worked super hard and like, you know, made a fortune and whatever. And it's like, okay, well, what is under that? And so when we tell money stories, we do both those things together as a way of like deconditioning ourselves from that mythology. If you'd like, I could actually share my money story with you right now.
Sure.
Yeah, it's
if you'd like.
Sure. Yeah, I'll do like a condensed version because they can take a while.
Okay.
I grew up moving between an upper middle class household and a wealthy household. My parents divorced when I was young, and I come from a family that has worked super hard, and that has experienced both unearned advantage and undeserved oppression, and that has participated in structural violence as a part of building the material security that we now enjoy. And so on my mother's side, we're from Scotland and England. We came over to Canada like 6 generations ago, settled in Manitoba, several generations of like working class farmers who received land through the Dominion Lands Act. That was directly stolen from the indigenous peoples of that land. And that's what allowed that family to, you know, subsist as a working class family, but still sort of secure and stable. And then my grandfather was in the Air Force in World War II. And already, you know, like the Air Force was the most prestigious wing of the military, and it was mostly white men who served in the Air Force. after the war, came back to Canada, and through the Veterans Assistance Program, was supported financially to go to veterinary school, so do university. First person in the family to do university. That program, in theory, was available to all Canadians, but if you look at who was actually able to access those government supports, pretty much no Francophone Canadians were able to access it, and pretty much no racialized Canadians were. So it was basically like a transfer of wealth from everyone to white men in Canada. And it allowed my grandfather to be class mobile. And then there was also a transfer of wealth, or a creation of wealth, that is sort of like erased from the story, which is my grandmother, while my grandfather was in veterinary school, she was working super hard to support them. And that's not, you know, that wasn't until I did this money story conversation with my mother that she sort of brought that to light in terms of like the hidden labor that is erased from our family histories because of patriarchy. Mm-hmm. And so my mother grew up upper middle class, rural. She went to university. She became a sort of prominent figure in the Canadian women's movement. She's done incredible work. I'm so proud of her. When my parents separated, there was a question of, you know, like where my brother and I would live with my mom. And a very wealthy participant in the women's movement offered to support my mother in purchasing a home for us to grow up in. And that money came from family inheritance via an insurance company that was built in the Great Depression, and that, you know, basically extracted wealth from poor Canadians via the insurance system, which is designed to concentrate wealth. I was able to grow up in like a nice home in downtown Toronto with my mom because of that wealth. My mother became an academic, is now a senator. So my whole life I've had access, you know, through her to a lot of social capital that I've been so grateful for and that I didn't do anything to earn. and then on my father's side, and because we're on a podcast, I'm not going to name numbers for my parents, but I will name my own numbers. On my father's side, my ancestors come from Germany and Russia, Jewish, fled persecution over there, moved to the US. And that afforded our family access to class mobility. So my grandparents both grew up sort of middle class, upper middle class. Their parents had entered into the pharmaceutical business. The story that we always casually had was that my grandfather, my grandmother, and my father moved to Canada when my dad was a kid because of a family conflict and came here with nothing and then, you know, worked super hard to rebuild. And it's true that they sort of were downwardly mobile and then worked really hard to rebuild. And a piece that I didn't hear until I really asked was that my grandmother's father had given them an interest-free loan to be able to sort of start a new business and start a new life. And they, you know, used that really carefully. And also they used it to build a business where, you know, they paid people basically, you know, close to the minimum that they were allowed to pay people, which we know is not what people's labor is really worth. And that my father experienced class mobility because of that economic behavior that was encouraged by society and by community. And so my dad became a corporate lawyer, and he became a corporate lawyer around the time when the economy started to transform from an economy that was growing at a rate that, you know, to different degrees was benefiting everyone in terms of like income growth over time. If you look at like World War II through the early 1980s, you see that whether you were rich or poor, incomes were growing. And then if you look at how the economy has grown since the early 80s, wealth creation and income growth has exploded for those of us in the top 10%, and especially in the top 1%. It's more or less stagnated for folks in the middle, and it's actually gone down for the poorest folks in society. Mm. And that's, you know, the financialization of the economy, corporatization of the economy, neoliberalism, all of that started in the early 80s, which is when my father became a corporate lawyer. Mm. And he's a person whose commitment to social justice I still respect in many, many ways. And he's a person who became wealthy being a part of the system that has concentrated wealth and extracted wealth from the majority of society And I grew up with access to that wealth. And so me personally, I was able to, you know, take lots of risks growing up because I had this like financial cushion and this sort of like belief that anything was possible for me. And so I've had a bunch of different kinds of jobs. I had personal savings, when I first started like thinking about this, which was a few years ago, of about $70,000, which were all savings that I'd saved from jobs I had worked, and which I thought of as my own, until I did a mental calculation of the amount in cash transfers that my parents had given to me since I was 18 years old. For like, they paid for my university, I graduated debt free. They gave me $1,000 a month while I was in university so that I could pay my expenses. They have paid for my therapy in times when I wasn't making much income, and all of that adds up to about $70,000. And so, you know, at the time when I was thinking about those savings of my own, actually, I would have still been paying off student debt if I hadn't received those cash transfers, let alone the vacations I got taken on and sort of like private school I went to and all of that. And I'm now in the process actually of receiving an early inheritance from my father and my stepmother, which is $250,000 over 3 years, and which I'm using 50,000 of that to support, basically subsidize my work so I can do this organizing work unpaid, and I'm redistributing the other 200,000, and that wouldn't have been possible if I weren't in this community of people who are supporting each other to recognize like what's not ours, and to recognize the healing work that comes from undoing those myths of supremacy that condition us to believe that, you know, we deserve the things that we have that we didn't actually work for, and that make us fragile to any connection that might threaten those stories that we tell ourselves and that make us comfortable. And so, yeah, that's my money story.
Thank you so much for sharing that.
Thanks for inviting it and holding it. And one thing I want to say about that story comes back to fragility, and comes back to that notion of those of us who carry fragility because of our privilege hearing difference or challenge as attacks. So feedback I've often gotten when sharing that story is that people who have wealth feel attacked by the story, feel like what I'm saying with the story is you need to give everything away. And I guess I just want to be really clear that that's not my intention with this story. And that, you know, what I believe and what we believe within Resource Movement is that everyone deserves to live in abundance. And that, you know, it's up to each of us to figure out what we need to feel safe and secure. And that those of us who are socialized into class privilege have work to do to push ourselves to recognize when we are like in a scarcity mindset, but that's actually not our material reality. And so, yes, like we do need to push each other to build our comfort with letting go and giving away. But that, yeah, being in right relation with others as a person with class privilege does not, in my opinion, mean giving away everything you have. I guess it ended up being kind of long after all.
It was very inspiring. And it actually really illuminated so much of my own money story and connections that I hadn't completely made. Mm. And so I'm really going to sit with that, and maybe the next time I see you, I'll share with you my money story.
I would love to hear it.
I would love to think it and put it together. Mm-hmm. Thank you so much. You're such a gift to this world, and
oh my God,
for all that you're doing on healing yourself and your relations and bringing to the light things that have been secretive.
Thank you for being a part of my healing and for healing with me.
Oh, yeah. Always. Thank you, John. Thank you for listening to Writing Relations Radio. This song is written by RJD2. To find out more about us, find us at writingrelations.org.